Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The world's wealthier countries have experienced a decrease in the number of people with AIDS, but in the developing world, where most of the AIDS sufferers live, they have not been as fortunate. There are many countries that simply don't have the resources to provide the medicines and the medical technologies to prevent the spread of HIV. This morning, on this World AIDS Day, we'll be looking at the effort to change the economics of AIDS treatment in the developing world. And our guest is Dr. William Rodriguez. He is an infectious disease medicine specialist. He has served as a consultant on HIV care and treatment for a number of national governments and also some major organizations, among them World Health Organization, the Gates Foundation, the Clinton Foundation, where he served as chief medical officer from 2003 until 2007. He's also co-founder and CEO of Doctari Diagnostics, which is a global health diagnostics company. We'll talk a little bit more about that. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to give a talk. And his visit here is sponsored by the Global Health Initiative at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. He'll be giving a talk at noon today in the auditorium of the Beckman Institute. And this is something that's open to anybody who would like to attend, so certainly you should feel free. We're very, very pleased that he could be here on the program. We'll be taking questions from people this morning, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Before we really start to get down to the topic here, talking with Dr. Rodriguez, I would also like to introduce you to Greg Damhorst. He's a student here at the University of Illinois. He's an MD-PhD student, one of the student leaders of the Global Health Initiative, the folks that brought Dr. Rodriguez here. And I thought we could take a couple of minutes here. I know you would like to talk just a little bit about the Global Health Initiative at the U of I. What's it all about?
Sure, and thanks. We're thrilled to be on here this morning. The Global Health Initiative is a new project that we started this year on campus. It's supported by a Focal Point grant from the Graduate College at the University of Illinois. And what we thought is we sat back and we looked at our campus and a lot of the great research that's happening, and a lot of the research that we might consider to be fitting in this theme of global health. And what we realized is that there's a lot of interest and there's a lot of great work, but we wanted to see more of it, and we wanted to see it sort of come together into a community on campus. So that's one of our goals with the Global Health Initiative this year, is to sort of coalesce a community around global health issues and global health research. In doing that, we think that we can create a capacity for more research of this type, and that we can also accomplish a lot of other things in terms of graduate education on this campus and sort of training leaders for addressing the global health problems that we face now and that we will face in the future. So in order to do that, the initiative this year has essentially three main programs. One of them is a trip that a group of 20 students and faculty will be going on, leaving January 1st of this coming year, to go to Ghana and to see firsthand some of the issues that are faced in that setting in healthcare, and to work with some NGOs that are addressing those problems. A second component is a symposium that is going to be scheduled for late spring next semester. And then a third component is a seminar series, of which Dr. Rodriguez is a part. In fact, he's our first guest this year as a part of that seminar series. And we are thrilled to have many different campus units come behind the Global Health Initiative, especially in the seminar series. His talk today is co-sponsored by the Micro Nanotechnology Lab and the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology. And we're thrilled, especially on World AIDS Day, to have him here as a guest.
All right. Well, I'm really pleased that you could make it possible for us to have him here. And welcome, and thanks very much for being here on the show.
Thanks very much, David. It's a pleasure to be here on the show, and it's a pleasure to be here in Champaign-Urbana, especially on World AIDS Day.
Just a general question. I'm curious just to pick up on some of the things that Greg was talking about. Do you think that there's some way in which meeting the global health challenge can benefit by institutions like this one taking a more interdisciplinary approach? One could understand why people who were in medicine and people who deal in technology issues could come together around this. Is there more potential for bringing people from different disciplines into this?
Oh, absolutely. I think what I've learned over the past decade of working in global health, and especially in HIV, we'll talk more about this, I'm sure, but HIV has really opened up the challenge of bringing multiple disciplines, multiple people from backgrounds in public health, in technology development, on the business side, in medicine, researchers, community activists. A lot of that has come together around the 30-year history of the HIV crisis, and especially in the past decade, as we realized what a global urgency HIV has become. Mm-hmm. And it's really the disease, you know, at one level, the disease is medical. You know, it's a virus and it causes an illness and people get sick and there are medications for it. But really, HIV is much more than a medical disease. It's a social phenomenon. And there are social and behavioral and anthropologic aspects to how you attack this disease to try to control it and prevent its impact. There are economic consequences to HIV, both because of the nature of who's getting infected. Productive, healthy people are getting infected and economies are suffering. The expense of taking care of patients who are sick for their whole lives has economic implications. So the very disease HIV crosses a number of disciplines, and other conditions in global health are similar. So we've had to reach out to cross outside of just the traditional focus of medicine into other areas.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that at this point, the way people in the United States and maybe in the industrialized world think about AIDS is we have told people that as a result of improved treatment and medications, that AIDS can be a chronic condition with which people can live for a very long period of time. Mm-hmm. And that is certainly a piece of good news. One wouldn't want to be casual about it, but that's a good thing. But then there's another part of this story, and that has to do with the places where most of the people who are HIV positive live, and the challenge of dealing with HIV/AIDS in the developing world in places where they don't have the resources to apply to fighting it that perhaps we do in the United States. So, you know, what are some of the particular challenges that go with working on HIV in Africa, for example, or other places that you've been in Asia and in the Caribbean?
Yeah, and let me just actually get back to the first point you said about the good news we've seen here and the way we think about HIV, and then on to your question about the rest of the world, because it is good news, bad news, good news, and let's talk through each of those just briefly. My personal story: I went to medical school in the early 90s, and when I was in medical school, you know, we had about a 45-minute lecture on HIV. It was some interesting new disease, and we didn't think much about it. Mm-hmm. I, third year of medical school, as Greg will find out soon, you are put in charge of patients and you're asked to take care of patients for the first time. And because of the timing of when I was in medical school in New Haven, which was an epicenter of HIV in the country, the first five patients I received to take care of as a young, you know, enthusiastic medical student all died of AIDS. And that was not something they'd prepared us for. We thought medicine was something different than watching young people my age die of this condition we could do very little about. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe many of the listeners don't remember what it was like in the early 90s when there was panic and there was a lot of fear, and AIDS had become the leading killer of adult people in the United States. It was an epidemic that caused major upheaval in a lot of areas of medical practice and society in the U.S. And everything changed in the mid-90s when we had effective drugs. And now, as you say, people look at HIV as, yeah, I agree, it's not something that be taken casually, but most people don't see it as the death sentence it used to be, because it's not. Mm-hmm. And there's now good data and good studies to say that if you're infected with HIV today and you get effective treatment, you can expect to have a healthy, productive life, and you probably would rather choose a disease like HIV than a disease like diabetes, which will have a greater impact on your life than HIV will, given how good the medicines are. So it's been a dramatic transformation from what was really a terrible situation 20 years ago to what's now a manageable but serious chronic illness. The rest of the world has had a similar transformation, but not to the same degree. And that's a resource problem, like you mentioned. So when I started working internationally, which was in 1999, when we really began to look outside the U.S. and I was just coming out of my training, we just had this experience where these dramatic life-saving drugs had become available, and realized all of our patients here, when I was in Boston at the time, had access to these fantastic new drugs, but 25 million people in the world were dying and had no access. And that was, you know, we the shorthand we use for that is it's a resource problem, but it's more complicated than just resources, obviously. That continues to be the situation for most of the world. Now there are 35 million people in the world with HIV. The numbers are beginning to plateau. It's been pretty steady there. And most of them are in poor countries, and most of them are poor people. 25 million of them are in sub-Saharan Africa. And that's where the focus rightly needs to be. We can't lose focus on people in the U.S. and the ongoing new infections here. It's still a problem. But a lot of attention has been played internationally. That said, the past decade, since about 2002 or 2003, we've begun to see the dramatic changes in the rest of the world that we got used to in the 90s here when the drugs became available. And as of today, the most recent report was released by the UN on AIDS this week. And it suggests that now 6.5 million people in sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia, in poor countries, poor people, are now receiving the same high-quality, top-of-the-line drugs that we have access to here and can lead healthy, productive lives, and they're all in poor countries. And that's been a dramatic change in the past decade. So there's still a lot of work to be done. But I think there's good news in that 6.5 million people now are looking ahead to a healthy, productive life.
Yeah. Well, then I suppose the question a question would be how was that possible, given the fact that these medicines are very expensive?
Yeah. So that's a great question. And I think there's a couple of different things that made it happen. The first that I think is important to acknowledge is advocacy. People demanded that this happen. And those advocates came from all over the world. They were the patients themselves. In the 90s, there was a lot of effort to get the United States government and researchers to pay more attention to HIV, and there became a very strong movement, activists protesting the way we see Occupy Wall Street protesting now, protesting about HIV, demanding new drugs, demanding new research, demanding that money be applied to people who are suffering from HIV. And that was different. Healthcare hadn't really been an advocacy issue so much in the U.S., you know, cancer to a certain extent has had its advocates, but HIV changed how patients and researchers and insurance companies worked together. They didn't really think about each other very much back then, and that all changed. That's what's happened internationally, too. There's been an enormous movement of community activists. Many of them are patients suffering from HIV who, rather than saying, I have this death sentence, got up and started protesting to their governments. And these are poor people who, you know, are subsistence farmers or who are living on $2 a day, who began marching in the streets of, you know, Johannesburg or Luanda or Lilongwe in Malawi and saying, we deserve treatment. And it's not okay that we don't have access to life-saving drugs when other people do. And that's had a dramatic impact. We had also advocates in the U.S. and Europe saying the same thing. Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, played a big role in demanding that this happen across the world. And a number of leading physicians, public health officials did the same. So that's number one, is advocacy had to happen. The second thing that happened is the resources that have now gone into address the problem of HIV have gone up dramatically. It's been a global effort. You know, I don't want to say it's on the exact same scale as the Marshall Plan was after World War II, but it's similar in its scope and in its reach. So when I started working internationally, first in Vietnam and then in the Caribbean, the total amount of money that was being spent around the world on HIV care was about $400 million. Well, that's a lot of money. That's not nothing. But for 35 million people, well, that's, you know, $10 per person or so. And that wasn't enough. Within 3 years, that had jumped to $3 billion. And now it's about $21 billion. And that's a lot of money as well. It's still not a significant amount of money per person who's infected. But that has enabled people to afford treatment and has enabled prevention programs to be put into place worldwide. And that kind of resource, which comes from the U.S., it comes from Europe, it comes from the countries who are affected the most by HIV themselves. South Africa puts an enormous amount of money now into HIV, have made a commitment to provide those resources. And that commitment also came from our global leaders who meet at the summits that they meet at in Davos, Switzerland, the G20, G7 summits, have routinely committed to providing those resources. Mm-hmm. So that's the second thing. And then the last thing I'll mention is the prices. And this was an area we worked on a lot when I was at the Clinton Foundation. We had to figure out a way to make the drugs and the diagnostic tests and all the things that go along with providing health care in developing countries less expensive. You know, it just wouldn't work if it were $10,000 a year to treat one person. And that's a complex story, but it really involved changing the way the market for healthcare works, which is a topical issue everywhere in the world, especially mm-hmm. here in the U.S. But the short story is that the prices went from $10,000 for a year of treatment to $100 for a year of treatment for the same drugs. And a lot of that is the economics of scale, of high volume. But a lot of that was the committed effort of foundations, philanthropy, the companies who make the drugs, the advocates, and the governments who all had to come together to figure out how to do this differently. And that's, I would say, the third thing that made this work. Yeah.
For anybody who just tuned in, I should introduce again a guest for this hour of focus. We're talking with Dr. William Rodriguez. He's a specialist in infectious disease medicine. He has served as a consultant on HIV care, treatment, lab diagnostics, and research in resource-poor settings for several national governments. He, for example, advised the government of South Africa in the development of its national HIV treatment program. He's also helped to develop clinical and lab programs in the Caribbean, in Africa, Vietnam, India, China. He's been an advisor to a number of organizations, the World Health Organization, National Institutes of Health, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Doctors Without Borders, and the Clinton Foundation, where he was the chief medical officer from 2003 until 2007. He's been on faculty of the Harvard Med School. He's also co-founder and CEO of Doctari Diagnostics, which is a global health diagnostics company. We'll talk a little bit more about that. He's here visiting the campus to give a talk. It's sponsored by the Global Health Initiative at the U of I Urbana-Champaign. He'll be talking at noon today at the Beckman Institute. So anyone who is listening is welcome to attend. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. I want to come back to the effort, as you have said, that others, including the Clinton Foundation, were involved in trying to work with major pharmaceutical companies so that they would be willing to provide the medicines at a lower cost. Now, did this... Are the companies doing this out of the goodness of their heart or because it's good for their image? Or can they, selling the drugs at those prices, if there's adequate volume, can they actually still make money doing it?
So it's a great question, and that's the root of the both the challenges and the successes that I think we've seen with HIV and now other medicines and other healthcare products across the world for poor countries. So it started as the former. I think the first efforts to provide HIV medicines to people in the developing world We're charity. We're essentially the companies were saying, we'll donate some medicines. You know, we can afford to donate a small number of medicines. And one of the first programs was in Botswana, excuse me, where Merck had one of the best HIV drugs. And they began working with the government of Botswana to say, let's set up a program where we donate some amount of drugs to your program and see if we can help this problem. And in Botswana, one in every three people was living with HIV, a massive, massive challenge for the government. Other companies then jumped on board and tried the same thing. Pfizer and Glaxo, a lot of the companies that made good drugs that were profitable in the U.S. said, we should set up donation programs as well. Well, that got things going. But when you quickly realize the number of people in the U.S. who have HIV that are getting treated and are buying the drugs is a million, and the number of people in Africa who need the drugs is 25 million, well, the balance doesn't work. You can't make that go very far. So the next thing that needed to happen was someone needed to say, well, we have to get the drugs to all of these people. Can we do it in a way that's not going to be a significant loss for these companies because they have to stay in business? And it was a difficult time because I think there was understandably a lot of – this was in, say, 2001, 2002, 2003 – there was a sense that it's not right to make so much profits off of people who are dying of a treatable disease. And it took a while for the people who had the view that drug companies are evil and really they're part of the problem here to recognize that to make millions of doses of a drug that works every time and that and to be able to make that available at some price that can be affordable is effort. And the companies, at least the good ones, they weren't all acting the same way, but some of them were acting in the best interest that they could imagine of patients worldwide, mm-hmm. said, we want to make this work, but we actually have an obligation to shareholders. We have we're not, you know, able to make decisions where we can make a lot of drugs for people and lose money on it. So help us figure out how to do it. We want to do it. And that's what I think happened in the early part of the decade from 2002, 2003, 2004. A lot of organizations were involved in trying to figure out, how do you change the market? How do you make this work? And you had companies, most of them, who said, look, we make great drugs and we know that and we want to make them available. And you had governments, South Africa, Brazil, Thailand, most of the African countries, Botswana as an early leader, saying, we're going to commit to support our citizens. We want these drugs. How can we get them at prices we can afford? And if you think of it from a pure economic or market perspective, you have an interested seller with a good product. You have an interested buyer with a big need. You need a broker, an honest broker, to help that transaction, just like in real estate when you buy a house. Well, sometimes in real estate when you buy a house. And that's what happened. I think the Clinton Foundation was able to play a neutral brokering role. Some other organizations, the Gates Foundation, some other governments like the Norwegian government, the Scandinavian governments played a role brokering this market. And the World Health Organization then stepped in and said, let us help broker the market. And what happened was, by changing the way that companies could sell their products so that they could make a small profit, small margin, so they could keep operating and do more research, but enable them to now sell those to millions and millions of people, the market transformed from what for us is in the way we purchase drugs in the United States. We purchase small volumes of drugs. There aren't that many Americans, but we pay high prices. Mm-hmm. And instead, we transform that market into high volumes, millions and millions and millions of doses per year, but at low prices. And it's more of a consumer-driven kind of market. But we had to change the rules of the marketplace to make that work. And that was the effort that took a few years to get going.
Yeah. We have a caller here. Let's bring them into the conversation. By the way, anybody can join us, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. This is a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
My daughter was in the Peace Corps from mid-2002 to mid-2004 in Belize, and her assignment was HIV-AIDS education. There wasn't actually that much going on. She spent most of her time working in a women's clinic, but there was no medicine available at that time. Prevention was the only cure. So I'm wondering if you know what the situation is in Belize and perhaps the surrounding Central American countries.
Yeah, thanks for the call. So that time you mentioned when your daughter was there from 2002 to 2004, it was tough everywhere. There were a lot of efforts to say, let's try to teach about HIV and let's do prevention programs. And one of the challenges we saw and learned about was when you try to teach someone about how to avoid a condition that they really can't avoid, well, those programs are challenging. And when we started trying to teach about treatment, but the treatments weren't available, and it's almost cruel to explain, well, we have drugs that can treat you, you should get tested. Well, you don't have access to those drugs, so I can only tell you you're HIV positive. And we realized we needed to get the treatments in place. So that time was a very difficult one, not just for your daughter, but for a lot of us who were working in countries like Belize. I happened to be in Africa mostly at the time. That's changed with the availability of treatment and with the availability of funding. So now AIDS education programs are so much more effective because you're not saying, well, you've got this horrible condition and we can't help you. You're saying we have a treatable disease and here's some things you can do to protect yourself. And if you are, unfortunate enough to be infected, here's what you can do to lead a healthy life. I don't know the most recent statistics in Belize, but I think they're in the category of countries where up to 60% of the people who need HIV treatment are now able to get it, which is obviously dramatically different from when your daughter was there. I'd have to confirm that number, but they're doing much, much better than they were 7 or 8 years ago.
And what about the surrounding countries?
Yeah,
Guatemala, Honduras?
Yeah, so Central America and South America have done reasonably well. There are a few exceptions. Guyana on the rim of the Caribbean and Haiti continue to have severe challenges getting treatment out to most people. But most of the Central American countries are in a similar situation to Belize. There's still a lot of new infections, and we still have to do a better job with prevention. But once people are found to have HIV and are diagnosed, they've been much more able to access treatment.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And we'll go to another caller here, Champaign County, line number two. Hello.
Hi. This period you're talking about, the early 2000s, I have a distinct memory of... You know, the what you sort of pointed to, this negotiation about the drug companies and various governments. And one thing you didn't mention was generic production abroad and the way the big pharma here in the U.S. And I am inclined to demonize them. And also, there was an episode where some kind of negotiation had been brokered, and at the last minute, in the person of Dick Cheney, an easy person to demonize, he came in and sort of threw everything up in the air and said, we're not going to accept the deal after all. I forget what actual year that was, and you may remember the episode differently or may not know, be able to comment on it. But this, you know, a lot of people died because of that, because of the lack of treatment, because of the agreement that had been brokered. They thought the U.S. was on board, and it seems to be fairly transparent that it was the Bush administration acting on behalf of Big Pharma that threw the deal up at the last minute.
Yeah, so there's a couple of good points here. Let me touch on each of them, and it's I certainly remember the time, and I was, you know, the Clinton Foundation was involved in a lot of those negotiations directly as a broker, so I'm quite familiar with most of the episodes. So first, your comment about generic pharma. So the generic production has played a critical role, and I should have mentioned that about the price reductions. A lot of those price reductions are because the equivalent of a generic production has been enabled, and a lot of generic drug companies in the developing world, especially in India and also in South Africa and in Brazil, are now producing the same drugs, the same quality drugs, the same efficacy. They have the same effect and power, are being produced in their factories, in their companies, and those are the ones that are being sold. The patents and the licensing around that, again, was difficult early in the decade, but has been pretty well sorted out for most of the drugs and most of the companies. And I'll just say that, you know, in my experience, just like in all walks of life, some of the drug companies have been very well-intentioned and very good actors and very supportive, and others have not been such good actors and so supportive. But they've enabled, collectively, the generic companies have enabled a large part of that price reduction. So that's one comment. The second comment, and again, I don't want to get too much into politics. I'll just say that I think the past 10 years have been a tough time in the U.S. for politics and decisions that have been made, and we've you know, it's obviously a challenging environment. I worked for President Clinton, you know, after his presidency, and I think the work that we did internationally was work that he was, you know, also starting to do when he was president. I will say that for President Bush and that administration, one of the most impressive things I've seen an administration do in my lifetime was the program that was started for international HIV called PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Program for AIDS Relief. And it came together because there was a convergence of interests from Republicans, from Democrats, from people of faith. And there's an interesting history to it. And, you know, I wouldn't say personally I applaud many decisions that were made in the administration, but I absolutely applaud that one. It's been a phenomenal program. And I think most people around the world, especially people living with HIV, would say the same thing, that PEPFAR has made an enormous impact. And the Bush administration should get its due credit for that. And I just want to point that out. I think there have been many challenges where our administrations have been less willing to devote resources and less willing to dive into a problem like HIV globally. And that one, I think we've done a good job on. And President Obama has continued that program. So it's been bipartisan.
If I might say something about that, is that I think that's unfair, actually. I think that he gets... You have at one hand the PEPFAR and the money that was put out, which had its limitations too, and I'm sure you'll mention those, which has to do with condom use, et cetera. But and the whole Christian right dimension of how it shaped that policy. But on one hand, you have them throwing up this deal that would have saved all these people, that would cut the costs, and then PEPFAR, which, you know, was wrong-headed in the sense that it was ready to pay the big pharma higher prices, it seems to me. So on the one hand, you have this highly promoted policy of PEPFAR that I've heard even natives from around the world, you know, say that they applauded it, et cetera. But on the other hand, you have this other machination going on that is actually responsible for stymieing it, basically, and slowing the actual access of life-saving drugs.
I'm absolutely going to agree. So you anticipated my savage attack on some of the challenges in the early days of PEPFAR and some of the issues with the drug companies and the protection we were trying to place on them. I just wanted to point out that the program itself has had a dramatic impact and not damn the entire program because of a few incidents that were pretty significantly difficult for a lot of people, including the one you mentioned. So the one you mentioned was really about international patent law and the ability of countries like Brazil, like Thailand, like the African countries to say, hey, these medicines are life-saving and we need to be able to use them at low cost and we need to be able to produce them in our country and we need to be able to distribute them and we shouldn't be beholden to these exorbitant prices that some companies want to charge. And the administration at the time did step in and try to protect the interest of the drug of the pharmaceutical industry as a whole. And the pharmaceutical industry certainly didn't get out of the way. They certainly were willing to be protected by the U.S. government. It was a pretty tough time, and I think there were a lot of consequences that undoubtedly meant more people died that didn't need to die if we'd been a little more farsighted about how we wanted to interact as a country with our companies and with the need for life-saving drugs to be provided to people around the world. And so I agree that there were some challenging moments. And the second thing you mentioned about PEPFAR, there were some pieces of the legislation that were very much driven by a religious agenda. That didn't really square with what the challenges were on the ground in places in Africa and Southeast Asia. My experience, because I lived through it there, was that the people who were responsible for implementing the programs in Ethiopia, in Rwanda, in South Africa, were able to work through that and get through that. It took a while to deal with the consequences of trying to protect some of the pharmaceutical companies, but we actually got through that relatively quickly as well. And I would say that today we haven't seen any long-term consequences. And I don't mean to underplay or underestimate the short-term damages that might have been done because we were not moving as quickly as we could have with some of these drugs. But I think we've found a way now to figure out how to make sure that the interests of patients are put first and that the drug companies are able to understand how to conduct business in a way that supports that. So.
We're talking this morning in this hour of focus with Dr. William Rodriguez. He's an infectious disease medicine specialist, done a lot of work in the area of HIV/AIDS internationally. He's here visiting the campus. We'll give a talk. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois. Now featuring new exhibits entitled A Century of Stories and Sounds from the Stage, Music, Dance, and Theater in America. More information is at sousaarchives.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the second hour of the program today, we'll be doing our monthly show on computers. That's a regular feature to give you a chance to ask questions about computers. If you're having a problem, you can get some advice. Celeste Quinn will be the host. Coming up later today, we'll be preempting the 1 o'clock hour of Fresh Air so we can bring you the NPR program Talk of the Nation. And the guest for the show is Gary Nell. He officially comes on board today as the CEO of National Public Radio, and he will be talking with the host of the show, Neil Conan, about NPR's role in media and our future direction. So that will be at 1 here on AM 580. One other thing we want to mention, we will be on off the air for a few hours tomorrow morning. This is from 9 a.m. until about 1 in the afternoon. This is part of our continuing tower work that we have been doing that we hope and expect will make the station more reliable during bad weather. We're sorry to have to interrupt the service. We appreciate your patience throughout the tower project we've been working on this fall. The programming on WILL AM will still be available online, so you can continue to listen at WILL.illinois.edu. Again, this is tomorrow morning, Friday, December 2nd, from 9 in the morning, and we hope no more than 1 o'clock in the afternoon. This is Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and again, our guest for this hour is Dr. William Rodriguez. He has served as a consultant on HIV care and treatment for a number of governments, He worked with the government of South Africa when it was developing its national HIV treatment program. He's also worked in the Caribbean and Africa, Vietnam, India, China. He's been an advisor to a number of big world organizations like the World Health Organization, the Gates Foundation, the Clinton Foundation. He's been on the faculty at the Harvard Med School. He's here visiting the campus to talk about these very issues. He'll be giving a talk at noon today at the Beckman Institute. This is sponsored by the Global Health Initiative at the U of I Urbana-Champaign. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. There's something else I'd like to have you talk about and tell a little bit of the story behind Doctari Diagnostics. We talked earlier in the first part of the conversation about one of the problems for dealing with AIDS in the developing world that has to do with the cost of medications. Well, there's another issue, and that has to do with the cost and the complexity of medical technologies, the kinds of things that you use to screen people to assess their, you know, how they're doing. You in this company developed a device, I guess a very portable, affordable kind of device to do screening on people. So tell us about Doctari Diagnostics.
Sure, it's my favorite subject, so I could talk forever about it. Just a few quick points. First, I didn't develop the device. A bunch of scientists from Mass General Hospital in Harvard and scientists who are now here at the University of Illinois also were involved in the development of the device. So Dr. Rashid Bashir, who's at the Micro Nanotechnology Laboratory, is one of the inventors of the technology that we're using, and then the Boston-based scientists. The Doctari story really comes from the work we did at the Clinton Foundation, and I should just say that when I started getting into global health and global HIV, I was a doctor. You know, I was there to see patients and take care of patients, and being a practical person, what I found was, well, initially, like we talked about, we didn't have the drugs. So it was very hard to take care of people in Vietnam or in Rwanda when you don't have medicines that they need. And so that's why I spent time at the Clinton Foundation and started working on systemic issues about how do you increase access to drugs at a global level, because that's what we needed to do. Well, we talked about how that problem has improved and 6 million people today are on drugs in the developing world. But the second part of the problem, which we quickly realized, was you also needed these tests that we sort of take for granted when we go to the doctor's office today. Here, they draw your blood and the next day you get a number back, or your doctor gets a number back and they know what to do. Well, it's the same thing, only it's much harder to draw blood in a rural village in Africa and send it somewhere and get a result. And that's because these are pretty sophisticated pieces of equipment, these chemistry analyzers that live in laboratories. So we had begun working with the large diagnostics companies of the world back in 2002 and 2003 on the same sorts of issues. Can we get lower prices for your equipment? And again, like the drug companies, they said, sure. We'd love to figure out how to get our equipment all over Africa and China and India. We see that there's money to be made. We're happy to do it at a lower profit, and we think it's important. So that effort went well, but it didn't go as well as the drug effort, and that's because it was easy to send pill bottles anywhere in the world. You just had to get a taxi cab or a motorbike to get it out to even the most remote part of the world, but you couldn't set up a laboratory anywhere in the world. So once we realized we were only actually reaching about 30% of the people with the current generation of laboratory equipment, we went back to these companies and we said, hey, this is great, but you need to innovate smaller devices, something you could hold in your hand, you know, like a Star Trek tricorder or a simple test that could do anything in your hand. And they said, absolutely agree. We see the need. We see that we're not reaching everywhere in Africa or Central America or Southeast Asia. There's just one problem with asking us to innovate new technologies like that. We don't innovate technologies. That's not what we do. Startup companies do that, and laboratories that work in universities do that, and they get technologies into startup companies, and we buy startup companies. So you're talking to the wrong people. We're trying to find those technologies too. So we got involved when I was at the Clinton Foundation in what ended up being startup entrepreneurship, and we didn't know much about it, and I didn't know much about it. And we found really interesting technologies, including the one that Dr. Bashir and Dr. Mehmet Toner at Mass General Hospital had developed and worked on. And we said, hey, can this do HIV-related tests and tuberculosis tests and malaria tests? And they said, we think so. Let's try. Let's see. And it could. So while I was still with the Clinton Foundation and we were working with the Gates Foundation, we said, hey, can we figure out how to develop this technology here, and can we do it with the people we have here? And we tried that for a year and realized, well, that's a terrible idea. You need engineers and product development people and scientists and chemists and mechanical electrical engineers, and we were a foundation. We didn't have those people on staff. So in 2008, I said, well, let me go figure out who can do this. So I looked around and found some funding and said, can someone please take this great technology and this great need and start a company around it? And long story short, about 2008, but ended up saying, well, I guess I should do it. And that's how Daktari got started. And Daktari, just so you know, it's a Swahili word. It means doctor. It's the honorific used for health workers. And we wanted to make sure it was clear that we were building something not to make cool technology, the most cutting-edge technology for medical problems in the U.S., but for medical problems in the developing world.
And the beauty of this thing is, as you say, it's an easily portable device, and that basically with the finger stick, like what you do when people now, you know, people use the idea of checking blood sugar that way, essentially, you prick your finger, you get a little bit of blood, you now can do some fairly sophisticated testing and get results back pretty quick.
That's exactly right. So for people who know glucose tests and sticking their finger with a little needle and getting blood into a small handheld device, it's exactly the same. Mm-hmm. So we're a few years into developing our first product, and it'll be a 10-minute test run on a battery. You could take it anywhere in the world, and it can do these complex tests you need to monitor HIV. They're called CD4 counts or T-cell counts or viral load tests. And we're also working on tests for tuberculosis and typhoid and all the other conditions that are causing significant impact in the developing world.
Now, and I gather now one of the trade-offs here is that the reliability, the accuracy of the test is slightly, and it sounds like really only slightly less than with the more expensive kind of technologies that we use here in the United States.
I think of people who work in software, there's a quote, I think it's been attributed to Bill Gates, but I'm sure he didn't come up with it, about when you're developing new software, you can be fast, you can be inexpensive, you can be accurate. Well, pick two. You can't have all three. And so the same thing applies here. You have to make trade-offs. And we wanted this to be simple to use. Anyone should be able to use it with a sixth-grade education. It needed to be inexpensive, just a few dollars per test. And it needed to be fast. We needed results in 10 minutes or less because so many patients need to be tested. And it needs to be accurate. But we're willing to trade off a little bit of accuracy because here in the U.S. we get focused on, you know, decimal points of accuracy on tests. But that's actually not what the clinicians in the developing world needed. They just needed to know, is this HIV, is this CD4 count 200? They didn't need to know if it was 201 or 202. And so we were willing to make that small trade-off. And when I say we, it wasn't us sitting in our offices and our labs in Boston and in Illinois. It was the people that we worked with in South Africa and Botswana and Kenya saying, please make that trade-off because we need a simple, inexpensive test.
Yeah. And is there truly no market for such a device in the United States?
It's a very interesting question. We are just investigating those possibilities, and we've had a slightly surprising amount of interest of we need those same tests right here in urban clinics throughout the U.S., you know, in rural sites where we actually have trouble getting lab test results back quickly. So we've been surprised at how much interest there's been in the U.S.
Well, that gets, I think, a pretty interesting question that people have raised when they have taken a look at what people working in developing countries have been able to do with AIDS and perhaps with other infectious disease as well. And people have raised this question, well, are there some things that we here in the United States with the level of medical technology that we have and also issues of access that we have, can you take some of the things that you might have learned by dealing with working with AIDS in Africa, for example, and can you apply that to the United States?
I think that's right, and I wish I could say we were smart enough to see it that way, but we've just stumbled across the happy result that we're making simple tests that anyone could use that are inexpensive, and it turns out, well, that's not just an issue people care about in poor countries. We care about that a lot here. Less expensive, simpler, faster actually will help. I think one of the interesting analogies, and we've been spending time studying this industry, is the cell phone industry. And if you look across Africa and the Southeast Asia, the developing world, the market for cell phones has just exploded. And more people have cell phones and use cell phones in the developing world per capita than in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about that is they've now begun to use their cell phones to do more things. You know, we have our iPhones and our Blackberries, and we do interesting, cool games, and there's some interesting apps. But really, in Kenya, they're doing banking all through their cell phones. They're basically doing financial transactions and have been for years, because it's such a simple technology that everyone can access. And we're catching up to what Kenya's doing with cell phones only today, 2 or 3 years after they've been doing it. And I think the same applies to medical devices and medical technologies and even drugs, things that we can make simpler, less expensive. We can learn from their use in those settings and bring them back to make healthcare delivery in the U.S. you know, more affordable and better.
We have about 5-6 minutes left on the program with Dr. William Rodriguez. We're talking about AIDS and HIV and fighting that in the developing world. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Have the kinds of agreements that have been reached with drug manufacturers so that you can provide medicines to people in the developing world at a price that everybody can afford, has that had an impact on pricing for people in the industrialized countries?
Yes and no. I think we've seen that the prices have come down slightly. But part of the agreement, and this was, you know, a negotiation, was to make sure that we didn't completely undermine their ability to make profits in the U.S. And, you know, that's something we had a lot of discussions about and a lot of back and forth with. A lot of the early HIV medicines came off patent recently, and so prices have dropped significantly for those. And then the generic companies that I mentioned before, who are in India and in China and South Africa, are now coming to the U.S. with their drugs, which are much less expensive to make. And so they're coming in and starting to sell those at lower prices. So we've seen prices come down somewhat, but I think the issue with pricing drugs in the U.S. is a lot more about our healthcare system and about insurance and government insurance than it is about the costs of the drugs being manufactured. And so the costs are inexpensive now, and we haven't fully benefited from that improvement here in the U.S. the way they have in the developing world.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're coming down to the point where we have maybe about 4 or 5 minutes. In the beginning part of the program, we talked a little bit about how one of the positive things that you can say about AIDS, HIV and AIDS, is that we now have good treatments and we have medicines that if people can get them, we can essentially make AIDS a chronic disease, something with which people can live and have good quality of life for quite a long time. Now, at the same time, there is this concern, perhaps, at least in the United States, there's this concern that, well, that's fine, but we don't want people to start really being casual about AIDS. And that they say, you know, this is a significant public health issue, and what we'd like to do is like to make sure people don't come into contact with HIV in the first place, you know. So it's very important that we continue to have an educational kind of effort so that people understand what AIDS is, understand what sort of behaviors put you at high risk, and so people will not do those things. And there, I think there is maybe some concern that the people are a little bit more relaxed about it, or a little bit more casual about it than they should be, because they think, well, you know, they're it's not a death sentence anymore like it was. I guess I wonder about how that is that, do you see that becoming an issue also in the developing world, where people may be getting a little bit more not as concerned about prevention because now avenues for treatment are there that weren't there before?
So in the developing world, less so. I think we've seen more casual response in the U.S. Just as a reminder, it is World AIDS Day, and as an HIV specialist, I should say to everyone, if you have any concerns or even if you don't, get tested, right? That's the only way we can actually control the epidemic, is when everyone gets tested. And that's not just me saying that. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control, the CDC in Atlanta, last year did a study, and they found we have roughly 55,000 new infections every year in the U.S., and that's too many. It's 55,000 too many. And they are now embarking on a massive campaign to say everyone should get tested, and should get tested reflexively. If you go to the doctor, you get an HIV test, just like you get your cholesterol checked. It's a health condition that we need to know about, and that's been a change from how it was before. The developing world hasn't seen that casualness yet. That said, there are some disturbing trends where there the number of unprotected sex encounters, the number of sex partners had all improved significantly in around the world, and we're now starting to see a little bit of slippage there. that more people are having are using condoms less frequently than they were a few years ago. So it's we need to pay close attention to make sure that we don't make the same sorts of steps backward that we have a little bit in the U.S.
Yeah. Just maybe one last thing. We have about a minute or so, and I realize this is really too complicated in that kind of time, but could you just say something about what the thinking is now about the possibility of a vaccine?
Yeah, it is too complicated. I would say there's good news and bad news. The good news is we had the first trial of a vaccine a few years ago that showed some efficacy, the term the scientists used to say it protected some people a small amount. So that was really the first sign and hope in what had been a bleak decade for vaccine development. The bad news is even if things keep going well, we're still looking 20 to 25 years out. You know, that's the most optimistic scenario. It's a really diabolical foe, this little virus. And the immunologists been working for a very long time in a vaccine and have made a lot of progress, but we have a long ways to go.
Well, we're going to have to stop there, but we do again want to mention that the guest for this morning, Dr. William Rodriguez, will be giving a talk at noontime today. This is at the Beckman Institute on the campus of the University of Illinois. It's free, open to the public. Anybody who would like to attend certainly should feel welcome. He'll be talking on the topic global health, HIV, AIDS, and technology. And as we mentioned at the beginning of the program, this was sponsored by the Global Health Initiative at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And I think that there's a website for the initiative, so if people are interested in finding out more about that, they can go take a browse here. Also in the studio, as we've been talking, Greg Damhorst. He is an MD, PhD student at University of Illinois and one of the leaders of the initiative. Any last thing you'd like to mention to folks about the initiative?
Yeah, I'd just like to mention that website. It's globalhealth.illinois.edu. So
all right.
Take a visit there.
Well, Greg and Dr. Rodriguez, thanks very much.
David, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.